If you thought Orwell's 1984 was dark or Kubrick's 2001 was scary, well, wait until you read Albert Brooks's vision of the future in his novel 2030 or 2030. That's right, it's science fiction set 19 years from now, and the most frightening thing is how completely recognizable and even inevitable it seems. It may inspire you to go to the Botanic Gardens and swat away, hoping that the butterfly effect will prevent his predictions from coming true. 2030 might have been a depressing read if it weren't also so darn funny. Albert Brooks was a stand-up comic before he directed and wrote six movies, including Real Life and Lost in America. He's a film and voice actor who was nominated for an Academy Award for his role in Broadcast News, and he's the possessor of one of America's finest comic minds. His book is published by St. Martin's Press. I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Seven movies.
Seven
movies.
Oh, what did I say?
Six movies.
Oh, which one did I leave out?
Probably. Well, how do I know?
I'm a little nervous about seeing you after seeing you on the Letterman show last night. This is radio, so you can make believe that you're kissing me.
Okay.
Are you basically a pessimist or an anxious person?
No, I call myself a very concerned optimist. That's what I call
it. And that's
myself.
What this book grew out of?
Yes, I don't
hope of changing things.
Well, I don't consider the book pessimistic because, you know, we're still here. Mm-hmm. There's many stories I could have come up with and I had thought of them where nobody's here. But I'm not a fan of Armageddon stories. They don't do anything for me.
Well, this is being called dystopic. Dystopic?
But that's what they call everything. That you know, somebody said something I thought was a compliment. They said what they liked about the book was that, like life, it's not all bad and not all good. You know, there's laughs. There's characters that are having actual good moments 20 years from now. But there's also stuff that's going on. And generally, because I don't call this science fiction, I think it's near fiction or near future. Mm-hmm. is sort of a better word. Because science fiction to me means, you know, 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Or 1984.
And
when 1984 came, we noted that the world wasn't like that. But
that's
there's a
right.
good chance the world will be kind of like what you describe here.
Yes, and I think the world will be like what Orwell described. I think it didn't happen in 1984, but certainly what he wrote it in 1948, and certainly the idea of people being able to listen and to know where you are and what you're doing, it's more real today than ever. It's not quite, you know, there's not big heads on screens in Times Square telling us what to do, but that could be in another 10 years.
The reviewers seem to be surprised that you were able to pull off a novel. I don't know whether they thought maybe you were being a little too ambitious. Like, who do you think you are, Albert Einstein or something?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, listen, I'm happy that people like the book. I
had you ever wanted to write a novel until recently? Because you've written films and you've written all your own material.
Yes, but what I found about the films was that over a period of time, I know what my budgets are and they're, you know, smaller budgets for movies. So you stop writing big ideas because you just can't fund them. And like the first movie I ever wrote, I had, you know, a bus explodes and a guy at Warner Brothers says, who's going to pay for this? Mm-hmm. You know, I had no idea. I thought you could just write that. So the idea of 20 years from now, I wanted to write a global story. I wanted to describe cars and robots and have cancer cured. And I wanted to do things that in cinema would be expensive. So I went to the novel form, and I just felt I was getting away with murder. I mean, I was writing anything I could think of, and nobody was saying, who's going to pay for that? It was just sentences.
And movies are also collaborative, so you have complete control here. You don't have to worry about whether an actor is ruining your cleverest lines.
Well, I've been lucky with movies. I've, you know, cast pretty much. I've gotten the people that I wanted, and I never worried about an actor ruining lines. I worried more that a studio might release it in four theaters and go home. That was more of a worry. But listen, you know, there's just immense freedom in a book, and it's lonelier. And you just gotta, you know, I think Neil Simon talked about writing that you just have to do it every day. And once you start a book, you have to do it every day.
That was different when you were writing film scripts?
Well, film scripts I wrote in a different way. I could write them in my car because I would dictate them into a tape recorder because they were mostly dialogue. And, you know, novels, somebody said to me, what's the difference between a film and a novel? And it's that in a script, the stage direction is unimportant. In a novel, it's everything. It has to read exactly as you want it.
Somebody who writes a lot of film scripts and also writes novels was on the show, and he said you can spot the difference right away because a film script, most of the page is white and there's a little bit of type on it. And if you do that sort of thing throughout a novel, you're not really succeeding.
If I was writing a script and I know that I'm going to direct it, I'm playing a character named Jack. Jack gets up and gets a cup of coffee. I don't need more than that. I know when the day comes and the camera's there that Jack can walk slowly, he can look sad. But a novel, I gotta say exactly what Jack is doing, and that I did on a keyboard.
Are you politically active? I don't see you hanging out with Jane Fonda and Sean Penn, but this book deals with many of our pressing issues: health care, government deficits, the power of the presidency, globalization, our relationship with China.
Yes.
Does this grow out of your reading of the newspaper every day?
Well, it's more than reading of the newspaper. I've it's been my business and my life and my passion to sort of have antenna stuck up in the air. I mean, you know, I made the movie Real Life in 1979 that made fun of reality television. So, you know, that's sort of been who I am. And I'm politically aware. Sometimes I'm active if there's something that I, you know, want to be active about. But, you know, to be very honest with you, I'll tell you, I flew around the country with Dukakis and tried to write jokes for him. And
that didn't work.
I didn't want him to be president after spending a week with him, you know.
Did he just not deliver the lines well or kill all the good jokes?
He just didn't get it.
You should have given it to Olympia. She really is very good in comedy.
I didn't know then.
What about reality television? I mean, as you point out, you were making fun of it in 1979. Who could have known what was going to happen in the intervening years? Now it's the dominant television style.
I think they have to rename it because it has nothing to do with reality. It's bad acting. It's phony and, you know, to think that is reality is really not. They need a new name for these Jersey Shore type television.
Or when they're going on great chases, or when they all sing sounding exactly alike, but some.
Everything is staged. Everything is staged. The only time they're going to, you know, I'll tell you the greatest reality show that ever was Candid Camera. That was a great reality show.
And you once made fun of it on Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
On what was it, the Paul Simon hosting show? I seem to remember that. In this book, the word virtual disappears.
Yeah, I said yes. What was the phrase? They don't. I forget my exact phrase. Virtually. That's what you just said. Yes, virtually disappeared.
It's almost impossible to know where someone is.
Yes. Well, that I think is true. I think one of the things. See, what I was trying to do is I don't like a future. In most books about the future, the future does not come. It comes slower than you think it's going to. And that's one of the things about reading. I bring up 2001: A Space Odyssey. Look, that was someone's idea that in 2001 we would be flying in space in that kind of comfort. I mean, you know, that's absurd.
On the other hand, the computer is huge, and by 2001 with miniaturization, HAL would have been a teeny little thing.
Yes, HAL would have been a teeny little thing. But look at speed. Speed has decreased. We don't even have the Concorde anymore. we're back to 585 miles an hour. So I think
you think that's bad, or they stopped it for the environment.
I don't think it's bad. I think that there's not an automatic guarantee that things are going to be faster or better. It's, you know, you need an economic environment for that to happen.
Well, in your novel, cancer has been eradicated. How did you manage to make that into a bad thing?
Well, it's not a bad thing, but it's Newton's law, right? There's action reaction. So if cancer's eradicated, then cancer is one of the natural predators. So that if you eliminate that, then you have baby boomers hanging around way longer than probably anybody wants them to.
And then Alzheimer's is also cured.
Alzheimer's is cured. But then, as I say, there's new diseases that I have a disease that I call virtual dementia, which is literally the inability to distinguish what's real or not. And people get nervous when real people talk to them because they're not used to it. So, you know, there's always something new popping up.
Is this all the fault of the baby boomers?
No, it's not the fault of the baby boomers.
But the baby boomers gave the impression that they wanted to live forever and they wanted to look young forever and never pay for anything.
Yes, I know. But if it wasn't the baby boomers, any generation after World War II, the 50s were going to breed that. I don't care who was alive. I don't think it's the fault of anybody. I think that, you know, without getting too serious, I think that overpopulation is a huge issue. It's always been warned about, and I think that that resources are strained to the point of what do you do?
And the demographics are skewed, at least according to the way things have been throughout the history of the world.
Yes. Well, in my book, I have what I called resentment gangs, which are young people who sort of, you know, they're not violent, but they're angry. They're angry because the pendulum has swung the other way and they can feel it and they don't like it. By the way, that's happening. How can you you can't write a book and just say, oh, everything's peachy. You've got to sort of say what you think is going to happen. But the end of this book, in a way, for me, is strangely positive.
The world is peopled by lots of 70-year-olds who look 40. Mm-hmm. But there's still a group who live a disadvantaged old age.
Mm-hmm.
We call those people poor people?
Unfortunately, I think we call them people.
Well, they can't take advantage of the medical miracles that are available to some.
Yes.
And they live in the ones who have all the advantages live in homes with a lot of security. What are they?
Yes. Well, yes, but there's also something else that we have in the future, and they're retirement ships, and they're very large cruise ships that are sort of plain. The rooms are small, and people live that way. And that's one of my main characters has to go there. And it's sort of like, you know, some people call them floating nursing homes, but they work.
My guest is Albert Brooks, who's written a novel called 2030, The Real Story of What Happens to America. It is published by St. Martin's Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Albert Brooks, who began as a stand-up and then just kept on expanding. The films occurred pretty early.
Yes, I started making. I made a short film for The Great American Dream Machine, which was a great PBS program. And then, when Saturday Night Live went on the air, they actually offered me to be the permanent host. But I didn't want to do that at that time, and so I sort of signed on before they figured out what kind of show they had, and I made short films for them the first year, and then I was hooked, and I liked the medium.
Do you feel that you were almost destined to go into comedy? Your father was a comic, although your mother was a singer, wasn't she?
My mother was a singer. My father went under the stage name of Park Your Carcass.
Eddie Cantor Show?
Yeah, Eddie Cantor Show. He had his own show, Meet Me at Parkies. He was on the Al Jolson Show.
And then your brother went into comedy?
Yeah, but I was the only one in the family that announced it like at 7, and everybody said, oh, get out of here. But, you know, I think what happens is that you see it around the house. My father died when I was young, but I was able to see it and know that it actually was a profession, you know, that it was okay. Mm-hmm. It was okay. You could laugh. You could make jokes.
Because most people fall into it. They talk about doing other things and then...
Well, I think most people who wind up in comedy are always the funniest ones in school, at least that. Mm-hmm. I mean, very few times.
The class clown.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think you have to spot it there. If you're not making your friends laugh at 10, I think you're not going to do it.
In one of the early chapters in this book, one of the characters thinks he's having a heart attack.
Yeah.
How does he get help?
He puts his hand in a device and a woman on a screen comes on and takes his readings and tells him that she advises him to jump up and down 10 times. And he says, "You're crazy." She says, "You're not having a heart attack. Just do what we tell you." And by the eighth time, he has the loudest belch he's ever had in his life. And he feels relieved, and it cost him $2,000.
So the healthcare package that was enacted by Congress recently has been replaced by something else.
Well, what it's been replaced with, I think this is going to happen, is more nurse practitioners and computers telling you what's wrong. If something is seriously wrong, you might get to see a doctor. But I think we're going to find out that there's going to have to be the idea of going to see the doctor is I don't think it's going to be so prevalent. I think you're going to have to see interim people first to see if you deserve to see the doctor.
Well, the government has solved the health care issue in that it provides coverage for a copay.
That's right. There's always a copay.
Uh-huh. Because the copay has become so huge.
Well, the copay for the gentleman thinking that he had a heart attack was $500. So, you know, see, he said to himself, "I guess before I eat pastrami and drink orange juice, I better be careful. It's pretty expensive."
With so many medical breakthroughs happening and about to happen, does anybody sign a DNR?
It's, you know, as you – that's a very important plot line in this book.
Oh, I don't want to give away too much.
Well, I don't either, but I'm just saying it does happen. That issue is brought up, and I will tell you, most people don't, because I've come to the conclusion that when people do that, it somehow signals that their end might be near. And people are so reluctant to sign something on a piece of paper that has anything to do with their death.
But China does everything a little more efficiently, and China has an entrepreneur who has, in fact, developed a healthcare system that works economically and medically.
Yes, and he's a very brilliant man.
And why would it happen in China? Right now, China is quite a repressive country.
Well, it's repressive in certain areas. Like, I guess if you and I did a show in China, we'd have to be careful what we talked about. But it's very advanced in entrepreneurial efforts, and there is so much room for improvement in China. It seems to me that China can start without an old business model. Mm-hmm. You know, China's not going off the 30s where we got to still do this because that's where, you know, they're at least able to say, how do we do it? You know, what do we do today?
Well, Shen Li, who comes up with this plan, becomes wealthy due to his entrepreneurship. And the American who discovers the cure for cancer also becomes wealthy. But there's a big difference.
Yes, because the American who cured cancer in the book is more of an old-fashioned entrepreneur. He's not, that was his great achievement. He's a little too old. It's like Jonas Salk, you know. After polio, it was pretty tough to come up with another one. But Shen Li's a young man and has very big ideas on healthcare.
When in the next 18 years will Goldman Sachs be renamed the Goldman Sachs of America?
That could be in 2 years.
You think so?
Yeah. It might be during this show. I haven't checked.
Not to get too personal, I read somewhere that your way of watching television with your friends is calling them and telling them what channel to watch and then commenting on the program while it broadcasts. Are you still doing that or are you now tweeting?
No, I went on Twitter at Albert Brooks to start to promote this book about 3 weeks ago. And this is, you know, this is a whole nother discussion, but I think it's the official end of creativity, this Twitter, because, you know, my whole being was deconstructing comedy, not doing Henny Youngman. And so I find that I'm back with, I have three sentences to get my point across.
It's really short. You got to do it in 140 characters.
You want a drum next to you. You bada boom, you know. So I'm trying to figure out the next generation of Twitter. How do you sort of do this without being Henny Youngman?
Henny Youngman, who had great one-line gags, and he really was truly funny, but your whole thing was about setting things up.
Oh, I took – it's one of the most famous pieces I ever did on The Tonight Show is I went 5 minutes without a laugh, and then when I got my laugh, it went on for a minute. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, that's what I love.
Which one was that?
That was where I claimed that I ran out of material. And I sat there and I told the audience seriously that I was 5 years into my career and I had nothing left. And then I told them, you know, what I said, but, you know, look, I could have fooled you. If I was, you know, trying to fool you, I could take my pants off. And I wound up doing everything I told them I wouldn't do. And I was sitting there in my underwear with eggs all over my head. And I looked in the camera and I said, but this isn't me. And they laughed for about a minute and 40 seconds.
Well, I loved your things with the ventriloquist dummy, including the one where the dummy drinks the water while you do the talking for him.
I'm glad I was alive before Twitter.
One of my favorite inventions in the book is the fake child.
Yeah, well, actually,
that was a fake child, an improvement over the real child.
Yes, well, they have fake companions, and as I say in the book, the fake child caused problems with pedophilia. So, in order to get a fake child, you had to make sure you had no record. It wasn't so easy. You couldn't just walk in and buy one. You had to pass some tests.
Some of these things almost guaranteed to come true. There's an earthquake in Las Vegas. Los Angeles.
Yes, that sort of sets in motion. And that earthquake, it's funny. I wrote this book, you know, I finished it 6 months ago. And I chose this number of a 9.1. And I had somebody at the publishing company say, that's too extreme. And I said, it's not extreme. And then that horrendous Japan 9.0 earthquake, you know, they had to call and apologize.
I believe
that's going to happen in Southern California.
You also make the refrigerator pretty much the center of all communication.
Yes.
And that's something that's probably going to happen as well.
I'm sure. That seems to be the place where the food is.
Do you think that, although the food isn't as good in the future, do you think that this book will ever be made into a movie?
Well, I've already gotten inquiries. The funny thing is, I don't know that I would want to direct it.
Well, James Cameron could do it in 3D, don't you think?
I'd give it to James Cameron. This would be 3D, and I would let him do it, and I would just hang around and make sure it wasn't bad.
But you do have a film at the Cannes Film Festival.
Yes,
I have this
movie in competition. Yeah, I play a bad guy, which was a terrific part, a movie called Drive with Ryan Gosling, this wonderful director, Nicholas Winding Refn.
So this is not a comedy.
No, it's not a comedy.
Because Ryan Gosling does
comedy. This is not a comedy. This is like a modern-day
Blue Valentine is one of the greatest performances I've ever seen.
Well, you're going to love this movie. This is like a modern-day Taxi Driver.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, that could be really scary. Well, meanwhile, we should mention that you will be reading and signing books tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Barnes & Noble store at 86th Street and Lexington Avenue. Do you like doing the book tour?
I've never I like talking to you. I've never done a book tour.
Yeah, but you've done the movie tour. Is it all that different?
Well, you know what? I'm so proud of this book, and sometimes you're in a movie, not a movie you make, but sometimes you're acting in a movie and you don't love it as much. I like this, so everything makes me feel better about it.
2030, published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much, Albert Brooks.
It's my pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, Moby discusses his new book of photographs from his album Destroyed, and then we'll take a look at how the Berlin Crisis in 1961 shaped the Cold War. Also, Jeff Dyer on a collection of essays and other writings called Otherwise Known as the Human Condition. And Word Maven Patricia T. O'Connor talks about ad-lib lines from movies. Well, Let It Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egancy, executive producer. We had help today from Carrie Barber, Jessica Miller, Max Bass, and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.